Morning, it's the United States against Clark. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Captain Nick McHugh, and I represent the appellant, Senior Airman Christopher Clark. Your Honor, with the court's permission, I would request 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, the facts of this case before this court today are very similar, nearly identical to the facts in the case of U.S. v. Alameda. What the government has done is take the same package that was put forth in Alameda, and instead of calling appellant's silence evidence of consciousness of guilt, they're calling the appellant's silence evidence of his state of mind. However, in this case, the result should be the same as was the result in U.S. v. Alameda for the same reasons. To be frank, there are about 4 or 5 different theories upon which I can lose this case, 4 or 5 different ways that appellant can lose this case because of how it's brought, and I believe that we lost on all those theories at the Air Force Court level. The first being that there was no error, the second being that if there was error, there was no prejudice. The third being that if there was prejudice, the prejudice can be proven harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The fourth being that the evidence was overwhelming. The fifth being that this issue was invited by the defense counsel and the government was rebutting what the defense counsel proposed. Because it seems to me that would be the best issue, the last one that the government has. I'll start with that, the issue of whether or not this was invited by the defense counsel based on what the defense counsel may have done at trial. And in arguing that, I would point out that the first evidence to discuss the fact that the appellant remained silent was, in fact, called by the government. And this was brought out by the government during direct testimony. That's the first time that the jury heard that the appellant had remained silent when he was confronted with the allegations against him. The defense counsel did ask that witness on cross-examination, isn't it true that the appellant told another person after he talked to you that he knew this person was a cop? And to which that witness answered that that was correct. Then the government called that person in their case in chief to bring out from that person exactly what the defense counsel had said. So this was essentially the government's witness. Afterwards, the defense presented no evidence. They rested. They did not call any witnesses. And then the government argued. And that's when the government argues that, in fact, that his silence is evidence of his guilt. So the defense did not open this door. And, in fact, the trial counsel opened this door and then walked through it. Any argument that the defense opened the door would have to hinge upon what the defense said in its opening statement. And if you read what the defense did say in its opening statement, it's one sentence. And I believe that's Joint Appendix, I believe it's page 50. No, I'm sorry, Your Honor, it's not in the Joint Appendix. The one sentence from the defense counsel. I apologize. That was an oversight, perhaps on my part, but it is in the record of trial, and that's why I want to bring it to the court's attention, specifically because it's not in the joint appendix. But I want the court to know exactly what the defense counsel said that may have perhaps opened this door, just to show that the defense counsel did not open the door. In the record of trial, the one sentence where the defense counsel talks about this, he says, or she says, what the evidence is going to show is that every time he talked to anyone about this, he explained he thought it was a cop. That's what the government is purporting to rebut with their witness when they call him on direct examination. What the government did, though, does not rebut what the defense was arguing. The defense was arguing that he said to a second person, I thought it was a cop. That's what the defense is arguing. They're arguing that this shows that, hey, all along he thought it was a cop, and his mind changed later on. So the testimony from a prior witness saying, hey, I told him that he was accused of communicating sexually with a minor, and he said nothing. That doesn't rebut what the defense is arguing.
Let me get this straight. The defense counsel in the opening statement said when he talked to anyone, he said he thought it was a cop. And what the defense actually is trying to show is that he talked to one person and said, I thought it was Cobb. Is that correct?
Very close, Your Honor. There were three, I guess you could call them conversations. I don't call the first one a conversation, but I think the government may dispute that. The first time that the appellant is confronted with this is in his driveway. And the investigator who testified says, I told him what he was accused of. He slumped his shoulders, he looked at the ground, and he didn't say anything.
Okay, that's the shoulder slumping incident.
Right. And the defense would say that that's not a conversation, because that you need two people for a conversation, and the appellant never said anything. The second time that there was an encounter, the appellant is taken into his house, and he's just made to sit in a back room in the house while, I guess, the police figure out what to do next. And while he is sitting in that room, he makes a statement spontaneously to another cop, and he says, I knew I was talking to a cop. I knew that person was a cop. And then, after that, he's taken to OSI, and at the OSI detachment, he's finally read his rights. He is again told what he is accused of having done, and we don't know the order that that happened in. One could have come before the other. But at some point during that conversation with OSI, he again made a spontaneous statement to the effect of, I knew this person was a cop.
When was he advised of his rights?
At OSI.
Or do we know?
We know from the record of trial that he was advised of his rights at the OSI detachment.
Do we know in what sequence events at the OSI detachment occurred? Or do we have to presume that they advised him before they asked him anything, or what?
Your Honor, it's not clear in the record of trial, because during the testimony of the OSI investigator, the question that was asked to him, I think, was, at any point was he advised of his rights? Or at some point was he advised of his rights?
Okay. Did he waive his right to remain silent?
Yes, Your Honor, he did.
After the advisement?
Yes, Your Honor.
Whenever the advisement was?
Correct. So what we have in this case is the defense saying, hey, he thought it was a cop all along. He knew that the person he was talking to was a police officer, and that's the spontaneous statements he's saying. But then after he's arrested, he's confronted, he's taken to OSI, he starts to think, you know what, maybe that wasn't a cop I was talking to. Maybe that really was a 13-year-old girl. And if you read his statement doesn't say, I knew when he was messaging her that this person was 13 years old. His written statement says, I was talking to a 13-year-old girl. So the defense counsel is arguing at trial that his belief in who he was talking to changed as this investigation went on. And after he realized that he was in deep trouble, the thought occurred to him, hey, maybe I actually was talking to a 13-year-old girl. And that's why his statement begins with, I was talking to a 13-year-old girl, as opposed to, I knew at the time I was talking to this person that she was a 13-year-old girl. Essentially, that was the defense's case. And the government purports to rebut that by saying, well, when he was confronted with this, he remained silent. Your Honor, that's not state of mind evidence. That's not consciousness of guilt evidence. Under the Fifth Amendment in U.S. v. Doyle, that can't be used against him. And under even the MRE's 304H3, it's not relevant. It's not relevant to any of the facts of this case. However, the trial counsel argued that it was relevant. Essentially, what the trial counsel argued was, if he was really innocent, he wouldn't have stayed silent. And they tied this into why he should be found guilty of the offenses that were against him. In his argument, the trial counsel says, if there is any remaining doubt, and there shouldn't be, so he's conceding that the jury could have doubt at this moment. What is in the appellant's mind when he's doing this? He says, if there's any remaining doubt. Well, there shouldn't be, but if there's any remaining doubt, look at the confession. That's what it is. That's a confession. And he's not talking about the written statement, though. He's talking about appellant's silence when he was confronted with the allegations against him.
You had five theories upon which you would lose?
Yes, Your Honor.
You've addressed the fifth, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
You want to hit the others or not?
Yes, Your Honor. Would the court have a preference as to which area I'm going to lose on that I'd like to address first?
You can ask government. No. No, I'm asking you. I don't want you to leave here and realize that gee, I wish I'd done 1 through 4 as well.
Yes,
let's
sir.
Say you're right on 5.
Okay.
We'll stipulate you're right on 5, so now you have to get past prejudice, don't you?
Yes, Your Honor, I do.
So why don't you get past prejudice?
Well, I believe this point goes to prejudice, harmless beyond reasonable doubt, and that the evidence is overwhelming. This point that I just started to address right now. Because the trial counsel is acknowledging that there could be doubt in the jury's mind. And that goes to show that the evidence is not overwhelming. The trial counsel acknowledges that there could be doubt. He says if there's any remaining doubt, and there shouldn't be, but if there is, look at his confession, for that's what this is. He says, and then a couple, I'll jump through where he explains, because he does explain.
Why don't you walk us through what evidence is in the record and why that's not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, Your Honor, as the government...
Or whatever it's supposed to be.
Yes, Your Honor. As the government points out, in this case, all the evidence comes from the appellant. And they've got him locked down for most of the elements of this offense. However, it's charged as an attempt case, which
does
means...
Does he confess?
He does, Your Honor.
So how do you deal with that?
Because all the evidence comes from the appellant in this case, we deal with that because his confession actually conflicts with two other things that he says before the confession, where he says, I knew the person I was talking to was a police officer. That's a conflicting statement from what he says in his confession. So what we have is conflicting evidence. If you believe what he said the first time, he's not guilty of attempt. If you believe what he said in his written confession, he is. So essentially, the question is put to the jury, which statement do you believe? This is a question of credibility and weight. Which one are you going to give the most weight to? Which one do you find to be the most credible? So anytime you have an issue where the jury has to weigh the evidence and it could go either way, I don't think it's fair to say that the evidence is overwhelming.
Well, didn't the members also have the online chat transcript, and didn't they also have the photos that appellant sent to what he thought was a 13-year-old girl?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, and...
So he thinks he's communicating with a police officer, and
yes,
he engages in this chat with a police officer, knowingly.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's
that
your
was the
argument
defense
against
trial.
Why that's not overwhelming.
Correct, Your Honor. And in this case, because in this case the government had to prove that he had that specific intent. They had to prove that he attempted to send these things to a minor. They had to prove what was in his head. And the confession is evidence of that. It's evidence that what was in his head was that he thought that this person was a 13-year-old girl. But we also have two other statements from him before he makes that written statement where he says, I knew that person was a cop.
So you don't think that if the members believed, as the lower court believed, that those statements were incredible under the circumstances, that the evidence didn't make any error harmless beyond reasonable doubt?
That's correct.
I mean, if he said to the police officer, it couldn't have been me because I was on the moon, would that interject reasonable doubt if it's inconsistent with what he put in his confession? I'm not asking you to concede. I'm just saying, I understand that you're in a difficult position for the five reasons that you stated at the beginning of your argument.
Right, Your Honor. But I still think that the defense gets over this hurdle. And I think the reason they get over it is because I think it would be reasonable to believe, given the circumstances of what's in the record of trial, evidence that the officer who was posing as the 13-year-old had in his profile that he was a 19-year-old. Now, certainly he was not a 19-year-old, but that's what he was saying to the world. Certainly the appellant could have believed that this was all a matter of role play. The thought that, hey, I knew I was talking to a cop, or I knew I was talking to somebody that was older than me, shows that perhaps maybe he thought that he wasn't talking to a 13-year-old girl, but somebody who just said they were one. And I think in this case, the jury could have believed that. I think the trial counsel thought they could have believed that, or else he wouldn't have argued in his closing statement that there could have been remaining doubt in the jury's mind as to whether or not the appellant was guilty. So where the trial counsel thinks that there could be remaining doubt, and he says, you're under suspicion for communicating sexually in a sexual manner with a minor the second time, And what is his response? Nothing. He doesn't respond to that comment. So he's explaining to the jury that this should be the final nail in his coffin. This is why you should dismiss that argument. If you're considering the defense's argument, if you think there's any merit to the defense's argument, stop. Don't leave your common sense at the door and realize that when he's confronted with this, he remains silent. And perhaps the judge's instruction or the judge's overruling of the objection to this argument exacerbated the error as well. There was never any instruction given to the jury that the appellant has an absolute right to remain silent during trial or even before trial. The jury was not instructed about a Fifth Amendment right in either case. Such instructions may have cured any error that existed, but they didn't come in this case. Instead, what happens is the defense objects, and the defense says, hey, he's using his silence as evidence. He's asking the jury to use his silence as evidence of guilt against him. At this point, the judge should have said, that's correct. You can't use evidence of silence as an admission of guilt, and then go on to rule either way on the objection. But instead, the judge simply said, I'm going to allow it in this context, without explaining to the jury what they're allowed to use this evidence for. So it made it sound like that he was approving of exactly the thing that the defense had objected to. Your Honor, I would also like to point the court's attention to U.S. v. Moss. In that case, this court held that there was a prejudice where the appellant was deprived of his best defense. Even if appellant probably would have lost at trial, that's not necessarily the test for whether or not he was prejudiced. Where the appellant actually did have a defense, he presented that defense, he argued that defense, the trial counsel conceded that there could be doubt in the jury's mind, appellant was deprived of that defense by the trial counsel referring to the fact that he remained silent in every relevant phase of findings during this trial. Your Honor, I see my time is about to expire. If there are no other questions from the court, I will request permission to conclude in rebuttal.
You can conclude during your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Captain Michael Rutkowski, and along with Mr. Roger Bruce, we represent the government in this case. The testimony elicited by trial counsel and his findings argument were focused on proper physical demeanor evidence, and any reference to the appellant's short post-arrest silence was not plain error and not prejudicial. Moreover,
which is your better argument, that it's not plain error, that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
The strongest argument would certainly be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, Your Honor, and for that, the government would be relying on United States v. Moran in this court's opinion in that case.
And is the government here trying to get this court to say that did he say anything no is demeanor evidence?
No, Your Honor. When we're referring to demeanor evidence, we're talking about the actual physical demeanor evidence that was introduced in this case.
So you would disassociate yourself from the lower court opinion, which concluded that because the whole thing was focused on demeanor evidence, it was okay to ask about whether he remained silent or not?
I guess I didn't read the lower court opinion as indicating that was proper demeanor evidence. I read it more as indicating that it was not prejudicial based on
the... However, it is clear from the context of the argument that the comment was, in fact, focused on the demeanor evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's not the government's view that it's accurate then, correct?
Your Honor, to the extent that there would be focused on demeanor evidence, it would come up with the... argument the defense already made for us, which was whether this was embodied by the defense counsel's claim during opening statement. And before I get into...
But that's a separate argument.
Yes, sir. Before I get into the specific legal grounds of our argument, I would like to set some of the facts straight. I want to make sure that we're clear what we're discussing. Defense counsel's page and a half opening statement focused on what the evidence is going to show is every time he talked to anyone, he explained this. He thought it was a cop, sounded like a cop, thought it was a cop. And then when it comes down to the actual facts of the case, it demonstrates that before he made any of those statements, he actually made admissions. Not only do we have the physical demeanor evidence, but on pages 70 and 71 of the joint appendix, the security forces members spoke that the first thing the appellant actually said at the scene was he was aware he had spoken to a minor on the internet, and also that he knew she was underage, And it was after he made those statements that he then said, I suspected she was a cop. The latter statement of whether he thought or knew it was a cop came after he already gave his oral and written confessions to OSI. So in this case, to argue that the first thing or that every time what he did was make the statements that he thought this was a cop or suspected it was a cop was actually factually incorrect.
Is it the government's position that demeanor evidence cannot constitute a nonverbal statement of an admission of guilt?
No, Your Honor. Actually, it's quite the opposite. We'd argue that the physical manifestations here were not testimonial, and therefore they were proper demeanor evidence that could be introduced in the case. And we rely on Supreme Court in Pennsylvania v. Muniz and this Court's opinion in United States v. Cook for those assertions as cited in the Air Force Court's opinion. Turning to
and
issue one.
Are right. those under current considerations as to what is or is not testimonial? Are those opinions still good?
I believe they are.
Why?
I haven't seen anything from this court that would state that physical demeanor is no longer admissible evidence or from our superior courts.
I understand that, but why, in light of what the Supreme Court has said about testimonial evidence, would a physical demeanor evidence constituting a nonverbal statement be excluded from the concept of what is or is not testimonial? What's the government's view on that?
Well, Your Honor, the majority of the concerns with Crawford and his progeny have been whether there was an individual to actually confront with that non-testimonial evidence. In this case, this would fall under an admission by the appellant, which certainly is 801D2A, I believe.
I'm not talking about exclusion for confrontation. I'm talking about the discussion of what is or is not testimonial.
I guess I'm not understanding the question.
Or is there, in the Crawford line of cases, there's a discussion of what constitutes testimonial evidence. Then whether something, if something is testimonial, then you get into the question of whether it's confrontation or not. Here we're not dealing with confrontation, but my question is, do those cases tell us anything one way or another about what is or is not testimonial for purposes of the comment on a person's silence?
And I guess, Your Honor, when it comes to a person's silence, there's certainly specific instances where that is admissible or not. Here we're focusing on the actual physical demeanor evidence, and when it comes to the silence, our best argument is harmlessness.
Right. In other words, the slumping as opposed to the not talking?
Correct, Your Honor. Turning to the actual...
Why is slumping, for the purposes of 304, failure to deny an accusation? Can't you fail to deny an accusation by slumping?
Your Honor, we would make the argument that the slumping and dropping her head, chin to chest, is all physical manifestations of his latter confessions in this case, where he basically, at the scene, not just at OSI, but at the scene, stated he knew he was talking to an underage individual.
So is your point that the slumping wouldn't come into evidence if there wasn't also other evidence that it related to, that this was... Is it the government's theory that this is not independent evidence, but rather it's linked corroborative evidence?
No, Your Honor. We're just making the argument here that, based on the facts, it's clearly supported by his latter confession.
I understand that, but as I understood the question that was presented to you, which was under Rule 304, why is this not evidence of a failure to deny?
Your Honor, we'd have to rely on the cases that permit physical evidence as proper demeanor evidence.
Regardless of whether it's implicating anything else, so demeanor trumps everything else, including constitutional rights. Because by golly, demeanor's the big dog here.
I'm not sure.
Well, that's what it sounds like. You're saying as long as it's demeanor evidence, it comes in. If it's demeanor evidence, it doesn't matter whether it also could be heard or seen or expressed as a failure to deny an accusation.
And Your Honor, we would argue that certainly the admissibility and then the weight of the evidence are two different things. This would be admissible as demeanor evidence, and certainly counsel for each side can argue what it actually demonstrates.
So it's admissible. So let's say, hypothetically, the question is, and did you ask the accused whether he did the crime? And the response is he slumped. And you're saying because that's physical, that doesn't implicate a person's failure to deny an accusation.
I would argue first, Your Honor, that's a completely different factual situation.
No, that's what I'm trying to get the legal question. I'm trying to figure out, granted. I'm trying to create a hypothetical where I can figure out which piece of the law you're arguing. I hear you saying that demeanor always trumps constitutional rights, and I can't really believe you're saying that.
And I'm not trying to say that, Your Honor.
And then I hear you saying that if it's properly admitted as demeanor evidence, that's the end of it. And we don't look to whether it could also be heard or read as a violation of 304.
Well, Your Honor, again, I'd have
to... And I'm trying to create a scenario which clearly violates 304 and then say that it also is clearly demeanor evidence and see which way you go.
In response to that comment, Your Honor, I'd have to rely on Pennsylvania v. Muniz, the Supreme Court opinion, that in that case, the defendant was charged with driving while intoxicated, and they stated his slurred speech in responding to preliminary questions was proper demeanor evidence, even though... It was also very incriminating evidence in that.
But that would be like
charge.
If this guy was charged with slumping, right? That's direct evidence of the crime. This guy is in charge of slumping.
Failure to maintain attention. When
okay. I think we're done with this.
Yes, right.
Line of question.
Move into our stronger argument.
Well, I have a question on that. I'm still not clear as to the government's position. Can demeanor evidence, in your view, ever be testimonial?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I mean, based on our prior case decisions, we've ruled it non-testimonial evidence. So
I haven't thought
of a situation where it has been considered testimonial.
What happens then when evidence of demeanor, a response, or a lack of response is entered into evidence? And then the trial counsel later argues that in closing, essentially was testimonial, argues to the members, okay, this was what he did, and you can take that to mean
that
he was guilty.
A lack of response.
And that then becomes testimonial.
Yes, and based on this court's opinion in Alameda, a lack of response, we would argue, is a different from an actual physical response.
So by his physical response, he's saying something, or he's indicating something.
Yes, Your Honor. It goes towards consciousness of guilt.
So in your view, this is the same as if he's asked a question whether he did it, and he nods his head. The slumping is the same as the nod of the head, and that's how it comes in.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that in that certain instance, certainly the government would be permitted to admit evidence that he affirmatively nodded his head to a question.
Is there any difference with the slumping? Isn't that what the slumping is being admitted?
Yes, Your Honor.
It's evidence here for? It's the equivalent of nodding your head?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
When he was asked the question, what did he do? Didn't he say he didn't say anything, he just slumped his head?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so it was both a statement regarding silence and a statement regarding slumping.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe if you look at the actual question in the record, what the trial counsel asked was, what was his response? And the agent did make a comment about
he didn't say anything.
And then also talked about
and
the
And then he slumped. Okay.
No matter what, our government argues that the strongest position on issue one is harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt based on the United States of Marine. In that case, this court determined it didn't even have to find whether there was error or not. Because of three factors that made the instances harmless. Those were that the improper references played a minor part in the case, there was proper demeanor evidence also introduced, and that the other evidence of the case was overwhelming, so much so that this reference did not tip the balance. In this case, we have oral and written confessions, we have the 75-minute chat, we have the pictures of pornographic pictures of the appellant, and we have the testimony of three witnesses. The government would argue the evidence was overwhelming, and based on those factors, this was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Consider as well the fact that there was a lack of objection from the defense counsel at trial, demonstrating that the defense counsel did not see the prejudicial effect of this, and the defense counsel had already brought it up in our opening statement. And we have no ineffective assistance of counsel claim against the defense counsel on appeal. Essentially, the government's arguing, even if there was an error here, it had to be harmless based on all the facts in this case. Turning to issue two, trial counsel's rebuttal argument was a fair response invited by the claims of the defense made both in their opening and in their closing statements, and that the first thing appellant did was make exculpatory statements to law enforcement. Both this court and Supreme Court have stated that where a trial counsel's remark is a fair response to a claim made by the accused or his counsel, there is no violation of the Fifth Amendment. That's precisely what happened here today. Defense counsel opened the door based on the comments she made in her opening and her closing. We've already discussed the every time, talk to anyone statement she made in her opening. Additionally, in her closing, she stated, what is it that appellant said right from the start? I thought it was a cop. Then, and she also says in her closing, what did appellant tell security forces? He didn't tell security forces, I knew the person was 13. He said, I thought it was a cop. Both of those were factually incorrect. In this case, before he made any exculpatory statement, he did make admissions to security forces saying that he knew she was underage and he knew he shouldn't have been talking with her, which allowed the government to come back in rebuttal and point out the facts of this case and argue what they were not. And in this case, that's what the government did in their rebuttal. They put the facts in evidence in the proper order they incurred in the proper context. Trial counsel made it clear that the first thing he said wasn't, I thought it was a cop. That was actually about the fourth thing he said. And the second time he stated, I thought it was a cop, was after he'd already confessed to OSI. Defense counsel objected, and the appellant has stated that the military judge's ruling in this case made it worse because he said he overruled the objection in the context. This court in Bear and Page has said you need to look at the argument in the entire context, and I'd argue if you look at the very next line, the trial counsel put his argument in context. The very next line on page 94 states, in the context, members, is when confronted with a crime, he puts his head down and his shoulders slump. And he goes on to talk about the two admissions he made to security before he ever made any comments about thinking this was a cop. If this court puts the entire argument in context, the government would argue it was a fair response based on the claims the defense counsel made in opening and closing. There are no further questions.
Of course, the trial counsel previously said the first thing he said by body language, right?
In which quote are you referring to, Your Honor?
Further up.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Furthermore, in the actual closing argument, appellant's counsel has stated that when he said if there's any remaining doubt, that trial counsel must have been conceding there was doubt. The government does not read that argument as this. If you look, he actually refers to the written confession to OSI before he gets into the other language. Additionally, reading the remainder of the argument, when he states stuff like, what did he do? The next response is, sometimes body language is just as powerful as verbal confessions. The government essentially would argue, if you read the entire argument in context, he's referring to all the admissions appellant made, both by demeanor evidence and orally, and why they undercut any kind of claim that he actually thought this was a police officer. If there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude? Reviewing the entire record in this case demonstrates that the testimony and closing argument complained of was focused on proper demeanor evidence through a clear physical reaction by the appellant. Any reference to appellant's short post-arrest silence was minor and not prejudicial. Moreover, the rebuttal argument of trial counsel was a fair response to defense counsel's claims in opening and closing. Accordingly, this court should affirm the findings and sentence.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Your Honors, there was a cumulative effect to these errors, and it culminated in the rebuttal argument of trial counsel that was sanctioned by the military judge when the objection was overruled. If, in fact, this was rebuttal, the trial counsel was rebutting with grenades when he could have been rebutting with direct fire. He could have rebutted the statement or the assertion that he said to everybody he talked to, I thought it was a cop, by asking the witness the question, did he tell you he thought it was a cop? But instead, he asked the witness the question, did he say anything? Twice, to which the witness replied, no. And then he specifically ties this into why the jury should find him guilty. He argues to the jury, nobody asked you to leave your common sense at the door. No one. The defense says the first thing he says is, I thought it was a cop. That's when the trial counsel goes into, does he say, wait a minute, Detective Garcia, hold on there just a second, I was just kidding. I actually knew it was a cop. Does he say that? I accuse you of speaking sexually with a child. I accuse you of speaking sexually with a child. No comments. No denial. no response. He is specifically arguing to the jury that they should use the fact that he didn't deny the accusations against him as evidence of his guilt. This doesn't rebut whether or not he had the specific intent to be guilty of the offense of attempt. This just goes to the fact that he exercised his right to not answer the question. And the trial counsel is asking him, and the judge is telling them that they can, use that to find him guilty of the offenses of which he's charged. In response to the question, can demeanor evidence ever be testimonial? There's a famous philosopher, I believe it was Kierkegaard, or maybe it was, began with a W, but maybe it was pronounced with a K. Regardless, I remember.
Kierkegaard begins with a K, I think.
This philosopher struggled with
Wittgenstein.
Sorry, Your Honor?
Wittgenstein.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, thank you. And he struggled with the question of, can true communication ever occur? And he was so disappointed in his not failure to find evidence of true communication that he quit teaching for a while until one of his former students was walking by his house and gave him the middle finger. And that's when he realized true communication can occur. And I would say to this court that that would be evidence of demeanor being testimonial.
I'm not sure, putting aside the philosophical implications, that helps you as opposed to hurting you in this case, because if it's a nonverbal communication that he made, would there have been any error in commenting on it?
Your Honor, I believe the evidence goes both ways in this case. It's kind of a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
In that perhaps his demeanor evidence could have been a statement, I don't want to answer the question, and the fact that he broke eye contact. If you remember, the trial counsel specifically asked, were you making eye contact?
But wouldn't that be a question for the fact finder to decide as opposed to a legal objection?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, absolutely. And if those fact finders had been appropriately instructed by the military judge, then perhaps there would have been no error. But we don't have any conclusions of law from the judge, any findings of fact. And on that point, I would ask this court to do a completely de novo review of the judge's decision to overrule the objection on the grounds that the judge did no analysis of this point. If he had, in fact, been aware of that and put some thought into this, and they had a discussion about it on the record before they introduced this evidence, and the judge had told the jury, this is what's being presented, this is how you can use it, possibly we wouldn't be here today.
Counsel, there are no further questions from my colleagues. You may briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. In this case, the error was prevalent throughout the entire trial, every phase of findings, and there was a cumulative effect on these errors. And the appellant asks this court to order a new trial.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for the arguments today. Case is submitted, and the court will be in recess pending further order of the court.
Court stands adjourned until further order of the court.